Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 54, recorded on January 26th, 2019. And this is the podcast where we like to go under the hood and tinker with things photographically, both with equipment, with concepts and technology, and try to be as geeky as we can about the whole experience. And I am so delighted to have a man that I've respected his opinion on for many years, and I've watched many videos of him tinkering and fumbling with technology for better or worse. With me today is Chris Nichols. Chris, how you doing?
Don, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And I think the highlight too is last year just getting to actually hang out with you. That was great. We've known each other for a little while. Never been able to hang out.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're in Calgary and I'm just outside of Toronto here, so there's a bit of a geographical inconvenience for that. But I hope to be in your neck of the woods more often. I have no idea when, but I'll try to make it work because that was a ton of fun. We recorded a macro photography video for DP mm-hmm. Review TV out in the field, and it was kind of a, I don't know what the heck we're going to do because the weather is not going to be cooperative, so we just had to wing it, and it turned out really good.
It actually did.
And if anybody hasn't seen that video, I would recommend, I'll actually put a link to it in the show notes. I think I've mentioned it before on this podcast when I had Jordan Drake on, your counterpart at DP Review TV that does all the behind the camera work and does all the video stuff. So, Chris, before we get going, if people aren't familiar with what you do and your interests, your passions in photography, you know, elevator pitch us right now.
Absolutely. You know, of course, now I'm the host of DP Review TV. It's been going really good for the last year. But before that, Jordan and I started TCS TV, the Camera Store TV, from a local retailer here in Calgary. That's how we kind of got into our YouTube world. And we're really happy to be working with DP Review, really, because it's nice not being attached to a retailer, although we tried really hard to build a reputation for being unbiased. When you're attached to a retailer, it's still difficult. People don't trust you. And with DP Review, well, they still kind of have their mean things to say. But it gives us a chance
to be... It's the internet. People have mean things to say.
They're just the worst. But it gives a chance to be more like journalists and really talk about the latest gear and technology and have a team of people who are very skilled at what they do, know photography and videography inside and out. So it's been a great ride for the last year.
Yeah. Well, and there's always going to be biases in some way. I mean, you've got your own personal biases. Sure. If you were working associated with a camera store, well, they might have spiffs or incentives to their salespeople that might push them to sell one brand of product versus another. With DP Review, it's owned by Amazon and there's advertisers from one brand or another. It's really hard to get an unbiased view of things, but I think you guys do it really well.
Thank you. Yeah, we try. Even at the camera store, we tried so hard to just make sure that if we didn't like something, we were honest about it. There's a few companies out there, I don't know if we should name names, but there's a few companies out there that really didn't appreciate our reviews, Don.
that lends itself to your journalistic integrity. So when you say something is good, it makes me believe you far more than if you just say everything is good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. No. And that leads into one of our first stories here, which this past week we've had rumors and teasers over the ensuing weeks up to this point from Olympus releasing a beast of a flagship camera, the OMD EM1X. And this is in similar to the Nikon D5 or the Canon 1D series camera bodies, where you've got the grip built into the camera under the necessity to always have more power, more room for electronics, heat dissipation, whatever, in order to produce a better product at a bigger, bulkier size for a specific audience. And this is the first camera that has come out on the Micro Four Thirds platform that has taken this route. And to me, I was originally interested in Micro Four Thirds because of the more compact size and a lot of the versatility that allows for. And yeah, this OMD EM1X will have the smaller lenses, but on a body that is quite beastly, that I'm not sure I would want to be traveling with, but I don't think that this is aimed at the travel photographer. The reason I have you on the show, Chris, I mean, I've wanted to have you on for a while and I was just looking for the perfect excuse, is you've had your hands on this camera. You've had a personal, I'm not sure how much time you had with it, but you've really dived into all of the new settings and features and everything else. So can you give us sort of a baseline to start the discussion on here, what your initial thoughts were?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I use Panasonic for my personal work. I've been in Micro Four Thirds for a long time. And just like you, Don, I really appreciated the small, compact nature of the lenses, the small, compact nature of the body. And there are some interesting things that you can do when you make the sensor a little bit smaller. And I feel like anytime a company's come out with a very large Micro Four Thirds camera, you know, even Panasonic G9 at first, I was like, ooh, this is getting pretty bulky. But now you have this OMD, EM1X, and it is, as you say, physically competing with full-frame SLRs. And so I think any reviewer's first reaction is, why would they do this? They're not playing to the strengths of their brand, and they're trying to compete with companies that, you know, have a very firm established foothold. And I think there's still some merit to it, Don. I guess if we're going to start off, the two things I would say, this is a strange camera. And it's really hard for it to find a niche, I think. And number two, I had the most fun I've ever had with an Olympus body using this camera.
Well, and there was a lot of really innovative technology that they put into this. And we learned at Photokina from interviews and maybe hearsay, I'm not sure, but basically that Olympus was not interested in joining the L-mount alliance that Sigma, Panasonic, and Leica were joining up. Because they were not going to be focusing on a full frame. They were holding and putting all their cards on the table on Micro Four Thirds. And I think this is part of what materializes when they start to do that. Interestingly to me, a lot of companies, we're talking the old guard like Canon and Nikon, will roll out new features on a non-flagship product. So they won't put it on the 1DX. You know, the dual pixel autofocus from Canon first came on a 5D series body.
Right.
And then the next iteration of that, once they had some time to maybe perfect it or redesign it a little bit, then with that polish on it, it goes on the pro level body. This camera from Olympus has a lot of new tech that I don't think I've necessarily seen before. So they are just, you know, throwing everything into this thing to make it as good as it can possibly be, knowing that they have to offset its bigger size with more features, right?
Right. You know, this is basically building on the EM1 Mark II frame. You know, I mean, it's a very similar kind of body internally, similar kind of sensor, very similar kind of autofocusing system, basically the same panels and EVFs. So, you know, I think, especially when people see the price point, we're going to talk about that quite a bit, I'm sure. You know, you see the price point, Olympus had to justify that. And they did, as you say, cram a lot into a flagship camera. You know, take a look at Sony's A6400, which also just came out recently and has a very similar kind of technology and a very similar kind of impact as the Olympus does. They put it into a very, I would even say, entry-level body, you know, their new technology as a test bed. So it's brave of Olympus to do this. It's interesting for them to do this, but I feel like it leaves them in a strange niche. At the same time, if you were going to get a full, a flagship camera and you wanted, you're paying a lot of money, I guess you'd want to get all those features.
Absolutely. But at the same time, I think that this is really interesting times photographically, because these new features are often, as far as I can tell, software advancements. So they have this new handheld high resolution mode that's not the full quadrupling of the resolution, which would put a 20 megapixel sensor at 80 megapixels. It gives you, 50 megapixels as an output? And it allows you to handhold it. And I'm not sure what secret sauce of moving pixels around and image stabilization they've decided to work into that. But if that algorithm, whatever that software is, could be applied to other cameras, maybe retroactively, maybe pushing forward, it just offers a suite of tools for other shooters within this to eventually get their hands on as well. And because there's so much of this stuff that can be done in software now, including some of the things that they've done with using deep learning and artificial intelligence to do much more intelligent identification of subjects. We're going to be linking to the story, which has a review that you and Jordan did, where you dive into all of these different features.
Yes.
You didn't have the most dynamic subjects moving around in front of you to test that out. I totally get what kind of time constraints and location issues you might have. But that is a feature that, even if it's not great now, can be easily improved upon in the next firmware update. And it's just, it's never going to be a static thing. It's always going to be a point of improvement on these cameras, even within a single generation of product. So there's some optimism there, I think, even if it's not perfect the way that it currently is. But it's also non-exclusive because everybody's going to be doing this. Yes. And so if Olympus has this as one of the cards that they're holding, so too does everybody else. And they're just trying to figure out where it's going to fit in their product lineup. And again, I've got no inside knowledge of what Canon and Nikon and Sony and all these other people are doing. But it's just, it's the next step in my mind, the next logical step.
It is always really interesting in the photography business where one company comes out with something that, you know, kind of gets people's imaginations going and people say, oh, this is more than a gimmick. You know, in recent memory, I would say Sony's actual eye detect autofocus, you know, one that actually works really well, revolutionized a lot of stuff. And so people start to say, oh, this is the standard to which other cameras are going to be measured. And now it's really exciting that we are getting into this deep learning technology, as well as a lot of the compositing of images that we already have in some of the latest smartphones. And that's what's really exciting too. It's the smartphone technology, the small sensor technology that's now going to be starting to come into these larger photographic cameras. I find that really compelling. You know, companies like Samsung, you know, Google with their Pixel cameras, they have these huge issues where they have to overcome tiny sensors.
Well, and you, sorry, I just want to cut you off because you made a really good point about the Google Pixel and for that matter, any of the iPhones or anything that Samsung is coming out with. A lot of the advancements that we're seeing within those cameras specifically, you can marginally improve the optics and you can marginally improve the sensor, but it's not going to be a drastic, you know, new feature set by just making those simple changes. It is the software-driven changes, the computational photography, as it were, that is going to make the biggest splash from generation to generation in product. And we're seeing the biggest advancements, I think, in those areas. But we haven't addressed the elephant in the room here yet, Chris. How much does this new camera cost?
Well, you know, it's about $3,000 US. So I don't know, that's probably like $12,000 Canadian, something like that.
Thereabouts. But, you know, $3,000. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, at that point, what are you competing with? You're competing with very, very good full frame mirrorless cameras on the market today.
Sony A9s aren't far off. D850s aren't far off. I mean, that's a crazy price point to start to try to compete in.
And so let's just try to figure out a market for this because they also announced, I think it was the 150 to 400 millimeter telephoto lens that has a 1.25 times teleconverter inside. I'm not sure if that equals to a drop of two-thirds of a stop or what have you, because I haven't seen many 1.25 times teleconverters. It's a really neat design and I'm looking forward to seeing that come out. The fact that they announced that at the same time as this camera, basically says to me that this camera, they want it to be in the hands of sports photographers, you know, whether it's motorsports, Olympics, you know, athletics, you know, team sports, et cetera, or any type of fast action or, you know, like wildlife birding photography, et cetera, where the current users of that equipment would otherwise have to be going with a full frame body and much bigger lenses in order to get the same feature set. So let's look at sports photographers. I think that it's kind of missing the mark there because these guys are stationary. You know, they're not going to be lugging their gear up a mountain and down, and they're not going to be, they'll often be using a monopod or something else, and they'll have a pre-described location where they can be. So the size of the camera doesn't necessarily assign any value to them. And they already have an investment within an existing system. It might be something for a new photographer who's just starting out and maybe has made the investment already into the Micro Four Thirds system to jump into the sports and you know, high speed wildlife kind of realm without having to completely change their gear. So that's one use case, but that's a relatively small market compared to the amount of research and development that has gone into this camera to justify that kind of a price point.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people out there are saying things like Micro Four Thirds is dead or it's dying. I don't necessarily buy that, but I can see where they're coming from. And Panasonic last year, we saw a big push in them to try to make a real appeal to wildlife travel photographers, people who want to have long lenses but don't want to carry heavy gear. They're trying to carve out a niche and say, hey, aging population, or people just don't want to carry any more heavy gear anymore. They want to be more free. And Micro Four Thirds is kind of a good way to do that. But as you say, are the sports professionals going to care? Probably not. Wildlife people, maybe. But then when you look at this new Olympus camera, their whole tagline was freedom, you know, freedom to go travel, freedom to hike. That's the sort of dream that they're selling.
that's what I use my GX9 for. And it's sure. A wonderful little camera. And I've used it professionally for about a year. And yeah, you know, okay, so Panasonic does sponsor me. I have to say that. But right. At the same time, if I had a whatever the successor to that camera is, that's ideal for me for a travel camera.
Sure.
And I can put a big lens on it. I took the Leica 100 to 400 lens with me to Bulgaria this summer, and it was small enough to just keep on me at all times. Whereas my if I was shooting with my Canon 100 to 400, that would only come out on very special occasions.
Yeah.
And it would never be carried with me unless I had a very specific objective in mind. So my wife and I were sitting for some after dinner drinks on this beautiful, like, pirate ship shaped restaurant on the coast of the Black Sea. And I noticed the sun is just setting in the distance and about to cross between some interesting buildings in the background. And so just in between sips of Bulgarian brandy, I take out the camera, throw on that lens, snap some wonderful photographs of, like, it looked like I had planned this for weeks, and then casually put the camera back in the bag and continued on with the conversation. You know, that is the freedom, I think, that a Micro Four Thirds system allows. And small lenses, okay, that's part of the equation,
sure.
But smaller camera bodies, I think, are an equal part of the equation.
I agree.
By weight, the OMD EM1X is 2/3 the weight of the 1DX, and that's a heavy camera.
Sure.
I shot with the 1DX and the 1DX Mark II over the past 5 or 6 years. Those two cameras were workhorses for me before I started using Micro Four Thirds for many of its advantages. And I've traveled with them. I would never want to do that again. I've hiked up mountains with them and said, this is just silly.
Yeah.
And so to have a camera body of that same weight, even if you're a landscape photographer and wider angle lenses aren't necessarily that heavy, I still don't want to have that big body to lug around unless it does something that no other camera can offer me.
Yeah.
And that brings me to the feature set. Like, it has Live ND, which is some wonderful software effects where you can combine multiple frames to create a blur effect without having to have an ND filter associated like on the front of the lens, which is always a nice thing to have, mm-hmm. especially if you want to be traveling light. It's a little bit of a balance there, although I don't think it pushes it quite far enough into my ballpark. But Weather sealing, it's actually waterproof rated. And I saw a video of somebody else actually submerging it in water and taking it back out, and it didn't stop. I would not recommend doing that.
No, but it can take it.
Yeah,
it could take it pretty well. I mean, Don, what they're really, when they say freedom, the thing that I really found, they're giving you freedom from a tripod in a lot of situations. Maybe that's going to save you some weight and space, but you're right, it is a larger camera. I did find it actually surprisingly comfortable to use, but it is heavier. And the big benefits I could see would be the new stabilizing is the best I've ever used. And you couple that with the body, the extra weight, the ruggedness, the stability, it was the most stable platform I've shot on. The high res mode, I was really impressed with. Handheld, I was getting amazingly sharp pictures. And, well,
and
without
they say it's without a tripod, of course, but they say that you've got 7.5 stops of stabilization if you have a stabilized lens plus the in-body stabilization combined together, which is, I mean, that makes a record right there. I don't think that there's anything else that quite competes on that level.
And it works. It works really well. Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, compositing images, getting the extra resolution, giving a sharpness. For macro work and for ND work, I would still want a tripod and real ND filters. I'm sure you would too, Don. But, you know, I could see some situations where a person could go out in the mountains and not have to carry that stuff. But it is an oddity because I want to see this in a smaller camera. I want an EM5 Mark III with this technology.
Well, and because a lot of this stuff seems to be software driven, and I'm sure there's hardware enhancements all over the place, but those are just necessary revisions based on the hardware being the next generation, not necessarily being bigger.
Yeah.
And I would love, and I'm going to pay attention to when Lens Rentals decides to take one of these things apart and does one of their famous teardowns.
Right.
Because I want to see what is in that grip area. I know that they have a double battery design.
Double battery
system. And there's some, like they're using that space well, but what if they could have made this without the grip? I mean, what if there was enough arrangement of resources inside the body to make this a smaller camera? And then I'm just left thinking, well, why did they have to go to this big size?
I don't know if they know what they want to do. I think they're pushing to the sports photographers. But then on top of that, you've got this new deep learning autofocus, which is great, but it's aimed at vehicles. I mean, I don't feel that these are necessarily the most difficult things to shoot and focus on. And it's not going to help you out when you're trying to get ski racers or eagles in flight or any of this kind of stuff. And frankly, the autofocus otherwise is fairly poor when it comes to tracking and very classic when it comes to having to switch between zones and moving your focusing point around and stuff. And this is something that I feel Sony has done way better because their system is far more universal.
Yeah. And I want to say kudos to Olympus for doing something that hasn't been done before. I mean,
sure.
this is a new format in terms of a very large Micro Four Thirds camera that might appeal to some. But a lot of these new features, the AI kind of hand-holding for certain things, the live ND, the handheld high resolution mode, they might make things more convenient. But that convenience, that to me is marketed towards a soccer mom type of photographer, right? Sure. I don't mean to stereotype too narrowly to just that, but you know they want to have great pictures and great responsiveness, but they want to make it as easy to use as possible. But that market isn't the large $3,000 camera market either. So
no.
It's kind of a mismatch.
I think what Olympus is trying to do is really address some of the issues that people have with small Micro Four Thirds sensors. So you've got the best stabilization, so you don't have to crank the ISO, a known issue with Micro Four Thirds. You know, you've got things like, having the autofocus capabilities, having the high res mode, so you can get over the problem where Micro Four Thirds sensors don't necessarily get good resolution or have a limit on how high they can go. So they're using technology to solve some of the issues that smaller sensors give us. And I think that unfortunately makes this camera a test bed and a niche. It's a good move, but I think it's going to be applied to future cameras in a far more effective way.
That's a great way to sum it up, a test bed. And they'll see what features people like and which ones they want to see improved.
Sure.
But I mean, the amount of money that it costs in research and development alone to produce a product that I can't find a market for means they're not going to sell a whole lot.
I don't think
so. Moving forward from that, I mean, every company needs to make money and they need to get a return on their investment. And Olympus has, there have been scandals within the Olympus Corporation over the past few years that have been quite notable. I hope that they can pull through this. I hope that this allows them to create that platform for which they can build their entire new series of cameras on. Clearly, they've got the patents and everything all sorted out for this new tech.
Yeah.
They just need to make it more accessible, I think.
I like that the tech is not gimmicky. It actually works. But yeah, I hope that this is a successful investment for them, because I really want to see this kind of technology, honestly, start to make its way into the smaller Olympus cameras. I'd also like to see a lot of it in the Panasonic cameras, because a lot of the same
competition,
same benefits,
right?
Yeah, same benefits would apply to the Panasonic sensors. And yeah, that would be excellent.
And it's funny too, because I'm still looking at cameras like my 1DX Mark II. I've complained about this many times that it does not have a built-in intervalometer. When so many lesser cameras, in fact, every smaller camera that I have ever used in the Micro Four Thirds realm has that built in as a standard feature. Yet Canon, and I don't know if Nikon does or not, because I'm not too familiar with the ins and outs of where they are. But the fact that I would have to plug in extra dongles and doodads onto, I think I paid $7,000 Canadian for that camera when I bought it. And it doesn't have that feature. It doesn't bode well for the old guard of camera manufacturers. But when you see Olympus being so innovative and all of the new guys that are trying to gain market share quite vigorously, there's hope that all of these features, if one company gets it, that the rest of them will all get it at some point. There might have to be a patent licensing deal, or somebody else has to figure out a different way to do it, which, I mean, I don't know if that's why, like, some camera lenses turn on one way and others the other way, and dials work forward or backwards on different cameras, because I'm sure there are, it's all patent encumbered in some shape or form. But we'll see how this progresses. I can't wait to see this camera get into more like actual working professional, not to say that you're not a working professional, but actual professionals in the field that would be using this camera on a full frame basis, and seeing how the results compare directly. And I think the proof will be in the pudding when we can see that.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to do great, Don, honestly, but I say kudos to Olympus for being brave. And this is probably the closest amalgamation of smartphone and camera technology so far. And I think that in the future is going to be incredibly exciting. Maybe not.
I think it'll be a necessary path that manufacturers will have to go down, at least for some segment of the market, because you'll have people that are exclusive cell phone shooters. And I mean, you have that now, and I think that's a growing number. And how can you then market to those people as a traditional camera manufacturer? There has to be like a Venn diagram between those two things, a space where you can design a product that will appeal to those smartphone shooters. So we'll see what comes. But thank you, Olympus, for this wonderful beastly beauty of a camera. So let's move on to the next story.
Sure.
And this one, it's interesting from an ethics point of view to some degree, and in what services you may or may not trust with your work. This is a story by Petapixel reporting that 500px, the photo sharing social platform, has banned a photographer for photos, quote, not being photographic enough, which I kind of get a kick out of. His page was gone. I'm going to cut to the end of the story right at the beginning. They ended up putting his account back because of all the backlash.
Right.
And the reason why they did that is because his work has been masterful in-camera compositions of multiple exposures and light painting, the likes of which I've seen some of the same caliber, but nothing beyond it in terms of what you're able to accomplish in camera with so many creative techniques that do not depend on post-processing. And it's so good in camera that it looks like it would have to be Photoshopped. I encourage everybody to go to the show notes at photogeekweekly.com and take a look at some of the stuff. Some of them I can figure out. Some of them I have no clue how he's done it. And that just makes me so excited. I mean, there's some that are pointing lasers at the camera, and I hear that's a bad idea. But he's come through that just fine. And a lot of this work looks computer generated or heavily Photoshopped. And the fact that you can do something like this entirely in camera, with light painting and multiple exposures, is gratifying to make photography art.
Oh, yeah.
And he was banned because 500px, maybe somebody complained about it, took his work down for not being photographic in nature.
I mean, you can't blame the editors too much, because the work really is astounding. And it, as you say, it looks like it had to have been amalgamated with graphic design tools and Photoshop to the nth degree. But yeah, just beautiful stuff. And yet people have been doing that for a long time in cameras. There's the photographer who likes to go out and compose everything in camera, shoot one frame, decisive moment. But there's also the photographer, and I would include you in this batch, Don, that there's a lot of prep, and it's about planning and thinking and preconceiving this image and then putting a whole bunch of steps together to make it happen. And when it does happen, it's a masterpiece. It's beautiful.
And I can tell you that for every masterpiece that I'm seeing on this page, he's bound to have had at least 20 to 30 complete failures that were stepping stones towards that success. You know, it's not just an immediate gratification type of photography. It takes, like you said, a lot of planning. You try to execute one piece of the puzzle until you get that perfect. And then you do that for every other piece. And then you try to start fitting them together, making mistakes at every step of the way until you finally figure it out and get everything the way that you want it to be. Right. Sometimes mistakes that you make along the way actually turn out to be a better idea or a different path to go on at a later date. And I find whenever I sit in my studio for an hour and I tinker on things, I'll get five more ideas than the idea I originally started with. And that's a problem because there's not enough time to explore them all. But you're looking at this and, okay, so from 500px's perspective, they were alerted by maybe an automated system. I don't know if they have an algorithm to detect things that might be computer generated or if it was a complaint. I'm not sure how that complaint process would work either. But there had to have been, I assume, a person that either approves or disapproves of complaints in the back end. And so I'm going to chalk this up as to it being a quick human decision because I would not trust this to automation because sure. it would quickly, you would see so many more of these stories and they would have to fall back on that. So if it was a human process, I would say, you know, possibly giving a warning to the person and allowing them to respond, to offer sort of a counter argument, I think would be a great idea. And sure. I hope that they implement something like that in the future because you can't just delete an account when they were following all of the rules, but you thought they weren't. Sure. So a point of explanation, I think, would be a really helpful thing. But, you know, 500px has been in unfavorable light, let's put it that way, over the last little while because they're now wholly owned by a Chinese company. And, you know, they were originally based out of Toronto. I think they still have offices there just south of me. And so I was, gaming for the good old Canadian team there. But now it's wholly owned by China and they've made some UI changes in the last little while that I thought just came out of nowhere, and some were great and some were so bad that people were in uproar over them. I'm not sure if you followed that at all, Chris, but it was such a drastic change to the way people use the service that they could no longer use the service the same way all at once with no warning.
Strange. You know, it brings up a lot of discussions. I mean, there is something to be said for a lot of these companies that we use. They started up free services, you know, they're not charging anything for it. They're just trying to get a foothold. You know, you've got your Flickrs and you've got your 500px's and your Instagrams for that matter. And, you know, these are outlets for people to use largely for free in a lot of cases. And eventually those companies get bigger, they get successful, money starts to become a factor, I assume. Things change hands and rules change and that's tough. But I think the bigger discussion really is, doesn't this bring up that same age-old concept in digital photography of where is the line? You know, when does an image become a photograph? And then when does it transcend that and become graphic design or computer generated or what? I mean, you could even argue the Olympus we're talking about, 16 images, composites them all together, throws out ones it doesn't like, takes information that's good from some and gets rid of the information from the others, uses image stabilization most of the time, and gives you one photograph, right? In camera. Nobody would say that's not a photograph. And yet, what's going on the back end to make that magic happen?
That's a very good point. Now, in the case of this photographer, we should mention his name is Tim Gamble from Manchester, UK. And he's combining multiple images. I'm not sure if it's up to 16 or not, but he is doing multiple exposures and he's doing a lot of behind the scenes secret sauce for artistic purposes. And so is a photograph art is really the question that I think it would boil down to. And unless you're a crime scene investigator or an insurance photographer, or something of that nature, then yes, it's art. And if you're a photojournalist, it can be both art and documentary work. And so there's different lines that can be drawn in that context. But if it has the elements of art and there's no documentary meaning that needs to be maintained, like you're not doctoring a scene and claiming it was real for a news story or something like that. If it is just pure art, and that's what this is, then it is photography, whether or not you modify it in camera or in post. And to whatever degree, some people will start to say, well, that's no longer a photograph. But then if I look at this work that's done all in camera and it is a photograph, then I'll say, regardless of the means to the end, you got to the same end and thereby it should be credited the same way.
Totally. I totally agree. We did so much of this stuff in the darkroom. It's not a new concept. You know, we did so much modification. We did, Unchart masks, and we overlaid multiple images. We did this kind of stuff, right? Nobody. Now,
I would say though, that if I can do it in camera, that image, compared to the same thing that had to be accomplished by software tricks, I'd always give the in-camera effort more credit, and it would win the award over, the computer aided design.
Absolutely. That being said, who knows, maybe we'll see some apps coming out where they try to take photos just like his work, but done completely with the click of one button. We'll see.
There's a filter for everything these days,
yeah,
right?
There is.
So, you could put sparkly bokeh by putting a camera through a filter. I'm sure you could add laser beams to a photo from a filter. You could add a kaleidoscope effect with a filter. There are filters for just about everything that he used, but it's refreshing to show, like you said, we've been doing this since the era of film. I remember an early composite, and I can't remember the author of it, that put a bunch of famous people together from different eras in the same image by combining exposures together. Just looking at that and not knowing how it was done, some famous photos from Stalin.
Sure.
When one of his top brass would just disappear, they would also disappear from all of the photographs that had been taken next to Stalin. You know, this is not a new concept, but the fact that it's done in camera and the fact that I'm sure he can prove it by showing his raw data. And
I
there
think
might
his
have
EXIF
been some
data was intact actually in a lot of those.
Well, EXIF data can be faked too, right? I can easily copy the EXIF data from one photo to another, and that's not a concrete proof. But if the raw data, the raw file can be presented, then, to anybody that wants to view it or privately audit the collection, then you can go ahead and do that.
In the end, is it going to matter, Don? I think we're going to enter an era of photography where, as we've talked about, software post-processing is going to be such a big part of our image making process. It's going to go well beyond just the actual capture of light, which we've always done up to this point. We're really going to a different kind of art form.
You can argue that we're already there.
Absolutely.
It's going to get more, but I think we're already in that era. This is the beginning of it right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, perfect. All right, well, that about sums up that story. Thank you for the great discussion there, Chris. The next one is curious. We're back to the gear side of things here. So this is a DP Review article. It says, Longsys launches Lexar-branded 1 TB SDXC memory card. So if you're not familiar with the storied history between of Lexar, their parent company, which was it Micro something? I can't remember.
Yeah,
it was Micron.
It was Micron. Yeah.
Micron, yeah. So Micron decided to sell the consumer brand of Lexar, or just they were going to close it down effectively. And a Chinese manufacturer, Longsys, decided to buy the brand. And I'm not sure if that meant all existing inventory or how it all worked out, but it's no longer a Micron product. It's a different manufacturer. Longsys is a Chinese manufacturer that can now use the Lexar brand exactly as if it was under its previous umbrella company. And they've started to release new products. This is one of the first ones. It is just a standard SD card, but at a 1 TB capacity, which is, we were going to get there eventually. And
sure.
And here we are. To me, though, and this is it cannot be glossed over, is that it is a V30 rating with a maximum throughput of 95 megabytes per second read. And that's the least important one. It's the write speed that you care about,
sure.
Which is a 70 megabyte per second write speed. But it can only be guaranteed at a 30 megabyte per second constant rate, which would be for video. And I'm not sure how much video you necessarily shoot, Chris, but I shoot quite a bit of it. And to have a card that's capable of dealing with 4K at higher resolutions or higher bit depths or HDR codecs or whatever it happens to be that you're throwing at it, that mean you have a gigantic funnel of data, cannot fit through that tiny bottleneck, right?
No, and Is this LongSys just trying to make a big splash? I mean, of course, 1 terabyte is going to get people's attention. It's going to get all over the news. And as you say, we were going to get there eventually. It's nice to be the first. But obviously, they can't sustain a proper transfer rate. And the people who need 1 terabyte SD cards are the people who are shooting 4K or getting in even into 8K, shooting 400 megabits per second in some cases. We need V90 cards. So yeah, I don't think this is going to win a lot of videographers' approval.
And I don't think it's going to win any still photographers' approval either, because there's no way on any excursion at all that you could possibly go on that you would need a single card at 1 terabyte if you're not shooting video at all.
You know, one person is going to call in Don and they're going to be like, no, I do this routinely. You're wrong. I need this every day. But yeah, I could see it having some application with people who need good storage and solid state memory. You know, I'm thinking more like police applications, cameras that are running constantly and need to record and record and record.
If you have a solar powered camera recording time lapse for 2 years straight in the Arctic Circle, maybe this makes sense. But then it's also suspect, because if the throughput rate is so low, it means that whatever controller chip that they have put inside this thing is subpar. Because there are controllers that can handle a lot faster rates on a lot lower capacity cards. And oftentimes when you deal with hard drives or SSDs rather in computers, if you look at all their detailed specs, which of course I do, the higher capacity ones always will have a higher throughput if it's not the bottleneck of the bus that they're on. It'll always have a higher throughput because you have more channels to access the memory because you have more memory chips on that particular unit. And so if we have that exact scenario here, yet we are not capable of the faster speeds, I doubt it's the memory chips that are the bottleneck. It's the controller that's associated with them.
Right.
And more often than not, if a card fails, it's either because the file system was corrupted and that can be recovered, but it's the controller that fails, not the memory chips themselves.
Yes,
so
exactly.
If you put a subpar controller chip in charge of 1 terabyte of your data, I'm not happy about that.
2019 seems to be the year of theoretical technology being put into a testbed format. It's really like, look at what we can do, but won't it be great 4 years from now?
Yeah, and at a price point of $500 for the card.
Sure.
I mean, it's an investment of that much money, and it comes with a limited life size warranty, but that doesn't return your images to you if the card dies. So, you know, the value of replacing the memory card really is a moot point. If you've got, you know, 200 gigabytes of valuable stuff on this card, like even at a fifth capacity, and you lose that, you lose things that you cannot replace. And so I want a memory card that is as robust as possible. And just looking at the specs on this, not knowing what controller or chips or anything are inside, the numbers just don't add up for me.
Yeah. No one's going to buy it. But as I said before, I think when you're trying to make a splash, everybody's looking at you. They've got their eyes on you. Maybe they're just going for the prestige of having that 1 TB on their card.
Could be, or it could be that the choice of controller and components make the manufacturing cost lower so that they could offer spiffs to salespeople at camera stores in order to sell these particular cards.
Yikes.
Which would then give the salespeople an incentive to recommend it. There's always two sides to that coin too.
Yeah. Now, very easily, I'm sure we could see better controllers attached to 1 terabyte SD cards very, very shortly in the future. And that is going to have some applications, especially if we can get those transfer rates sustained at V60 and V90 ratings.
Amen. Well said. Okay. Next story, our final story for the day from F-Stoppers is it's an interesting kind of concept based on how much work you want to put into something versus what that work is worth to you. So originally, Peter McKinnon, who actually lives nearby too, he put out a video that basically said, done is better than perfect. But is that actually helpful? This article here, oh geez, what was the guy's name that was critiquing him? It doesn't quite say that in this article, but we'll put the link to this article and the video questioning that theory. But basically, if you put in a little bit of extra effort and polish onto something and, you know, give it your all, then I think that means or makes a valuable difference at the end of the day. we all have deadlines, right? There's no question that if you're going to put something out, it's got to be put out unless it's a personal project that can take you 10 years and you're at no rush. But I'm in the middle of my Snowflake series right now. I'm putting out one image every other day and sometimes in the in-between days putting out some other stuff too. But that's a tight deadline with 4 to 5 hours of editing.
Absolutely.
For every one of those images. I get it done, but I could do it in 2 hours and get maybe 90, 95% of the way there. Is that extra 5% of effort worth the dramatic increase in time that it's worth when you're producing art?
I think it is to you. I don't know if the client's necessarily going to notice that. And I think that's something that we've always seen in photography business for years and years and years, right? What the photographer knows is their best work, and what the client's actually going to appreciate are two very different things. And you're also really, really good at it, Don. I mean, that's the other thing, right? I mean, you know what you're doing with these things, and it's a passion for you. I guess it would really depend on who it is, because I would say I'd call you a perfectionist in so many ways, you know, because your work is perfect. But for me and what I do every day, as we talk about deadlines, I'm in a very unique position. So I'd say I'm on the other side of that fence. You know, I think people, I don't know if people realize, I mean, we put out a video every week, and when we go shoot, we shoot on a day where if the light's good, we shoot. If it's not good, we shoot. We have a day.
Yeah, if you have the appropriate subjects, you shoot. If you try to drive to a location to get the appropriate subjects and they're not there, you still have to shoot.
You still have to shoot, you know, and it's tough. I mean, I miss the days of being a photographer where I could just say, oh, the light's beautiful, I'm going to go do it, as opposed to being like, I have to make something that people can consume online today. And so, you know, yeah, I don't have time to spend on all my images. I certainly feel like sometimes just getting it so that we can show people, teach them, help them learn is more important than making the best art for me. So I have to compromise on what I want to do so that we can deliver a certain amount and a certain kind of photograph.
It's value, right? And I think it all comes down to the value proposition, because if you put in a certain amount of time to produce a video, and that instead of making that video take 2 weeks, you give it 1 week, and the next week is entirely different content. And so if you get 85% of the way there in 1 week, where 2 weeks would have gotten you 100% of the way there, but you get two videos out at 85% of what would be considered perfect, you are still adding more value than had you produced only the single video, right?
Sure. Absolutely. I totally agree. And especially in the nature of YouTube or online where, you know, I mean, I don't know if consume is the right word, but maybe it is. You know, we have to deliver, we have to make content for people. And there's deadlines and time limits for that, for sure. And yeah, you know, Jordan's a great example too, because, you know, so many videos online now with YouTube, you see a lot of jump cuts, you see a lot of quick transitions, a lot of just sitting at a desk shooting. And we always made the decision right off the bat, like, no, we're going to put some extra time and effort into production value. And that's why, you know, Jordan doesn't sleep and his eyes are like, you know, deep and bagged and he's really tired and grumpy all the time.
Yep. But, you know, I look at other projects too. Like, I'm just installing a gallery exhibition at the Simcoe County Museum. Anybody in this area of the world, in Simcoe County or nearby, check it out. It officially opens up on Monday the 28th. Might be delayed a day, I'm not sure, but all the pieces are being put into place. And it's a gallery exhibition of all of my snowflake and freezing soap bubble work, which includes very large panels. The snowflake print, which is, it took me 2,500 hours to create. It's printed 140 inches tall. Wow. And it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. But I didn't want it just to be a display of the art. I wanted it to be all of the knowledge, the different types of snowflakes, how some of them have color, and describing exactly that. How do you shoot a freezing soap bubble? You know, what's the bubble recipe and all of this stuff. And so that's all up on the walls in this gallery. But when I was putting together all of these vinyl panels, I started, and it was a big mistake, writing the text in Photoshop and forgetting to spell check it in Word. And so once you see a spelling mistake on a big panel like that, it just drives you nuts. But I was pushed against a deadline. And so I wasn't, crossing every T and dotting every I specifically. And so we printed some little patches and we covered up the spelling mistakes. And it's impossible to tell unless you know what you're looking for. But again, I was against a deadline. And so you got to do as much as you can in order to get that out and ready for public consumption. So I think there's both sides of it. But
absolutely,
if you can put in the extra effort, instead of just walking off the job and watching TV, you want to put in the extra 10, 20, half an hour, 2 hours, whatever it is, to get closer to that, what your personal 100% is, without driving yourself crazy or ruining your family life. I think it's a worthwhile endeavor. Don't just settle for good enough when you know you can make it better. Even if your client is going to be happy when good enough is good enough, just that little bit of extra effort will make that client come back to you again and again. Case in point, I've got another client. They get me to photograph tiny little electrical components like microchips, like chip antennas and transistors and things like that. And some of the ones I was working on today were so small. They were smaller than even the tiniest snowflakes that I photograph in little arrangements and showing all the variety of products that they offer. And they've come back to me 4 or 5 times with more and more products. And they've just given me like a dozen new images to photograph and present to them. And my deadline is Monday. But I'm putting in the time on the weekend to make sure that I give them the best possible results, because that's what I did before. And they kept coming back.
For sure. And, you know, you're really talking to craftsmanship and how important that is. But I'll throw a wrench in it too. You know, what about the fact that a large majority of us consume and view photography on inferior display devices? You know, I mean, I always say it, like, everything looks good on Instagram, because it does, you know, and even our computer screens and our laptops are terrible as far as showing the true beauty and craftsmanship in a photograph. So if we don't display in a way that's going to show the extra benefit, I guess we're going to have to really be starting to deal with many different arenas of photography, where we need craftsmanship and where we need content.
Well, and you know, when we're pushing into the triple digit megapixel range, which I'm sure, I mean, we already are in medium format,
right?
With Fuji's got theirs and so does Phase One and others. But when we get that level, I think I Canon has prototyped some sensors, and I'm sure other people are working on stuff like that, or pixel shift technology, you name it, that gets you close to that level. You've got a lot of data, more data than you could ever hope to display on any 4K or even 8K display.
Yeah.
And that's far more resolution than you would ever need for a print, you know? And so, I mean, we're going to have the quality and the data, but I mean, what are we going to do with that? I'd make a lot of prints. I was mentioning right before we started recording that I've got a 60 by 40 inch canvas that I'm going to be shipping off to Australia. Somebody has bought that, as well as a 20 by 40 canvas. And I got to figure out how I'm going to crate those up now. I mean, I don't print that big often, but when I do, I'm glad that I have good quality pixels in order to work with, or at least proper upscaling technology, like On One's Perfect Resize, or Photoshop has a new one in there now too. But if I have that higher resolution to begin with, and I've got the means to properly display it, then we're golden. But you need both, right? If you have a perfect display and you're throwing up a 1 or 2 megapixel image, it's not going to play to the performance of the display, which I'm trying to make a segue into your pick of the week here at this point. So, because that's at about the section that we're going to be in. And Chris, you've told me that you've got a certain affinity for some new televisions that I don't know if they're on the market yet, or fill me in.
Well, you know, I need a new TV, Don. I'm still stuck with this ancient Samsung. I think it's like 34 inches, which by today's standards is, you know, basically like caveman technology. So
my computer monitor is 32 inches. So
oh, that makes me feel better, Don. It makes me feel a lot better. And so, you know, LG have these new OLED displays now. I mean, they've got their W8 series, their C8 series. But really what's interesting, you know, it goes right into our conversation. I love printing. I haven't done it in a long time, though. But I love printing. I love the concept. It's always been not only a beautiful way to give someone a tactile experience and something they can look at, and they shouldn't touch it, but they could. But it also gives them the proof of whether you did your work properly. You know, you can't hide mistakes in a photograph. on print very easily. But yes, you can hide them on Instagram. You can hide them on standard def and high def. And now, of course, 4K and 8K TVs, as we just talked about, the megapixel demand is nowhere near what our cameras are capable of. And yet, I feel like TVs, OLED displays and whatever we're going to have in the future, you know, these are going to be our main display devices. And, you know, what's amazing about these new LG TVs, not only that they support now HDR photography and HLG metadata, but also the fact that they're basically picture thin. You can put them on your wall, magnetically mount them to your wall, and they look like a photograph.
Yeah, well, and I've seen some of those magnetic mounting ideas where and you build the necessary sockets right behind the TV, so everything is all nice and flush. And I'm shocked as to how thin and light. They basically have no bezel on them anymore.
Yeah,
that's the area between the edge of the display and the edge of the actual device itself. So on my 32-inch display, it's maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 centimeters or so. But now that's shrunk even farther. Oh,
they're down to 1/4 of an inch or 1/8 of an inch in some cases. Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. You could frame it. You could literally frame it with a frame if you wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah, and so is this something that you see as the future of displaying photography? Instead of buying that big image to put over the couch, you buy a big TV and you have one on each side, one for you to watch content on and the other one for you to just passively display artwork.
Sure. I mean, we're already getting their smart TV technology. It's kind of like old news now, right? We can watch Plex, we can watch Netflix, we can surf the internet on the TV. And yeah, it makes sense that these displays will become more and more integrated into all aspects of our life. I'm sure there's a lot of photographers that are even editing on these displays as we speak now, you know? And I know a lot of them are using them to display their work to potential clients that come into the studio or come into the home to look at what they do.
You know, a few years ago when we bought this house, I was thinking of how I would build my studio and classroom. It's a room just adjacent to my office, and how I would display presentation content. And I was going back and forth on whether I should just buy a massive LCD television or if I should get a projector. And I opted for the projector because it would be then mobile. So if I were to go and do a presentation at a camera club, I could bring my projector and make sure that, you know, I'm color calibrated and it's a very good one and not just an $800 projector that's a decade old,
right?
And my work's not going to look that good. So I went for the projector for that. But it was not cheap. I think I paid like $6,000 for the projector because I wanted a good one. And for the price of TVs at that time, I could have had a really kick-butt television on the wall. I'm not sure exactly how many inches it would have been at the time, but it would have filled a significantly similar space.
Yeah.
So how big, what resolution, and what price points are these TVs at now these days?
Well, I mean, these TVs are going to be, we're getting up to 77 inches, 88 inches. I mean, you can get a display size for pretty much any application you'd want now. But the costs are still incredibly high. I mean, you know, basically it's about the same as an OMD EM1X in a lot of cases. So, you know, we're getting up there. I still think we're in early days, you know, but especially when we start getting into things like HLG video and HDR technology, we're getting displays that are getting us closer to that holy grail where we will have not resolution that matches human vision, but certainly getting close to contrast, getting close to dynamic range. You know, I mean, those are getting close to color accuracy. So I think that's really where the market's going to go. And as much as I love printing, and we kind of talked about this before we started recording, it's not dead. I don't think it's going to die. It's always something you'll be able to do. And it's a wonderful thing to just be able to hold it and feel it. But yeah, our modern technology, I think TV displays are going to be the future. And I could totally see myself watching videos one day, watching movies with the kids the next, playing video games the next, and then editing photos the next.
Yeah, and it'll be a centerpiece to a home. It'll be an interesting thing. But yeah, it's funny too, because when I published my book, Sky Crystals, which is a 304-page hardcover book on snowflakes, including the science and the photography and everything else, I did a crowdfunding campaign that was successfully funded, and I'm going to cut out all of the stress and failures that led to the eventual success.
Right.
but I ended up with 3,000 copies of a hardcover book. And a lot of people say, well, who's buying books anymore? Well, I'm not trying to like toot my own horn or anything here, but I have 8 copies left. and it was never available in retail. So it was all direct sales. And yes, I sell prints and other things too. The physical medium will always have a value. There's reasons why people listen to vinyl records, and it's not because the audio sounds better. It's because it's a different experience overall. Sure. When people buy art, they're often buying the artist more than they are the physical piece of art. That's why a scribble on a piece of napkin from Van Gogh would be worth more than my collected works will ever be worth. Not because it's any good, but because it's from Van Gogh. So, I mean, from that perspective, displaying artwork on the wall won't have that buying the artist kind of value to it, which a lot of people will always be seeking. But that's the art buying market. And that's not the casual person that walks into Walmart or Best Buy and picks up a pre-built, ready-made canvas to put on their wall because they like the colors and it matched their, the wall paint.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, no, I think I'm really excited to see it. I know it sounds kind of Star Trek, but really TVs are going to start integrating with our phones, integrating with our computer systems. Yeah, I think it'd be great to be able to edit right on there on the TV completely wirelessly, send photos right off to it instantly from phone and display the same photos that we're looking at our phone. I need a new TV, Don. It's
well, time. If you decide on the TV or at least the exact, the model range, maybe not the size, make sure you send me a link so that I can put that into the show notes and that everybody can take a look at what Chris is pondering for his new television.
Ooh, well, I can tell you right now. Yeah, I mean, it looks to me like a C8 is probably what I'm looking for, the C8 series. They've got new processors in these TVs now that handle a lot of the back end. And I'm looking at a C8. That's what I
Perfect.
Want.
Awesome. Thank you very much for that recommendation. No, and I wanted to tie in one of the stories that we talked about that just came across my radar when Jordan Drake was on as a guest host was I discovered an article, can't remember where I found it, I think F-Stoppers. They were talking about this, a device called a microfogger. And it was basically a tiny little portable handheld fogging machine. And so as soon as I saw the article, I went out and I bought the device.
Of course you did.
Of course
it looks awesome. I looked that up too. It's a really cool thing.
And it's fun because I have like a big fog machine, but that is so overkill for when I'm trying to do macro photography and trying to add just a little ambiance to the scene, or maybe I'm making something glow or I want to see a light ray or something like that, hitting a certain part of a very small subject. If I run my main fogger for 1 second, the entire scene is obliterated because it's so like it's right there, right on top of it. So this little guy here, I can press this button on and it might take it a while to prime, but there you go. Chris can see me, but nobody else can because we're not recording the video, but this can create a giant cloud of smoke pretty quickly, but I can dial down the wattage on this so that it produces a much softer output, slower. And so it's pretty versatile with that regard. And it just, it burns, I think what all microfoggers do, just got this little jar here of vegetable glycerin that it comes with.
It's and like a 3 milliliter reservoir, I think, something like that.
Yeah, and it's got a 50 milliliter kind of refill thing and a little pipette to refill it. So with that, it costs 85 British pounds, and I haven't looked up the conversion to US or Canadian dollars right now. But in terms of an investment to add an extra dimension to an entire array of photographic subjects, if I were to leave this thing on for a longer period of time, I'm sure that I could add a little bit of extra fog to a room even on a larger scale. But for that price and to have something that will fit in your camera bag very easily if you're going out in the field. And you can, I'm sure you can get like a crab clamp or something to have this mounted on a tripod if you wanted to have it in a static position, which I haven't had the opportunity to do yet. But it's a tiny little device it's useful. And so totally. It does get my recommendation. Jordan, when he was on, he asked me to comment on it, whether or not it stinks. And it does kind of stink. I mean, anytime you're burning glycerin into smoke, it's going to have the same kind of smell. I guess there's just no way around that. It charges via USB. I've never had to recharge it for the few times that I've used it. It still says it's got a full battery. So well-made 3D printed casing on it. So you can tell it's kind of a DIY. These guys thought up an idea and they found an inexpensive way to produce it using whatever hardware that they've come up with, an atomizer from a vaping system or whatever they've put into this thing, it to me, as a photographic tool, I think is well worth the investment.
I'd love that, like just in your camera bag for doing portraits on the street or quick video work. So yeah, maybe we'll have to invest in that, and we'll have a lot more smoky ambiance in our in our reviews.
If
for no reason whatsoever.
Well, I mean, yeah, to throw on a fedora and make it all worthwhile. but it's those kinds of little things that are not photographic gear specifically. It's something on the tangential area around photography that can improve the quality of your work. I saw an image recently where somebody took one of the larger scale foggers and, with permission, added fog to a forest scene. And made artificial fog that looked just like natural fog had rolled through the scene. And it added so much ambience to that. And to know that you can create that on a big scale or on a small scale, I think is useful just as a photographic tool to have in your tool belt.
Very, very cool.
All right, Chris, we have come to the end of another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. Where can people find you, and what are you going to be working on next?
Well, of course, always follow me, just chris.nichols on Instagram. That's pretty much become my main outlet for the work that I do. Of course, deepyourview.com, we have all our sample galleries. I don't know if people know, but not that my photos are anything worth writing home about, but on deepyourview.com, you go to the sample galleries and essentially steal all my work and do whatever you want with it. I mean, that's kind of part of the deal. So, but it does give you an opportunity to see the photos right out of camera, play with them yourself, see what you can do with them. But yeah, check out deepyourview.com, go to YouTube, Deepyourview TV, and what do we have next? We're actually going to do a comparison again on the Olympus OMD M1X, but more in terms of its video capabilities. There was so much to talk about. We didn't get to talk about
that. Yeah, you hinted at that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we're excited for that. That's going to be our next video coming up. And we want to get some wooden Nichols in there too. You know, there's a lot of cool video cameras coming up. So we're desperately trying to find the time, really, Don, to shoot another wooden Nichols. But I would say stay tuned for that. That's going to be coming up pretty soon too.
All right. I'm looking forward to it all. And maybe some of those future videos will have a little bit of extra ambiance in them, thanks to one of those microfoggers.
Microfogger.
You'll find the links to where you can find Chris in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com. You can find me at doncom.ca. That's my personal website, my portfolio. But we'll find you'll have the links to every social media platform that we're on at the bottom of the post. So you can tag along with whatever antics we're up to. Thank you, Chris. This has been an enlightening conversation. You are such a great person to talk to. Some wonderful ideas were exchanged, and I hope to have you back on in the future.
I appreciate it, Don. Anytime. It's always good to see you. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
Thanks so much. And for everybody listening, it's time to get out and shoot.